Hi, I'm Dr. Akiva Down.
And I'm Rabbi Avi Green.
And welcome to Interesting Questions.
In this podcast, we'll be addressing issues that are philosophical, religious, and psychological in nature.
We will be focusing on that which is considered to be controversial, and there may not be a right or wrong answer. So we are hoping that our discussions will yield more questions for your Shabbos table.
Shavua Tov, and welcome to Interesting Questions. We are on the fifth perek of Pirkei Avot. We are going to do Mishnayot Yud, Yud Aleph. Yeah, let's do those today. Maybe we'll get even a little bit further. Shiva Mine Puraniyot Ba'in La'olam. There are seven kinds of punishment that come into the world. Al Shiva Gufe Aveira. For seven kinds of transgression. Miktzatan Ma'asrin U'miktzatan Enan Ma'asrin. If some people tithe, and some people do not tithe. Ra'av Shel Batzoret Ba. A famine from a drought ensues. Miktzatan Re'evin U'miktzatan Tzve'in. So some people will go hungry and some people will be satisfied. Gamru Shelo La'aser. And if everyone concluded not to tithe, Ra'av Shel Muhuma V'Shel Batzoret. Then there's a famine from armed bandits and from drought. V'Shelo Litol Et Hachala. And if it is from not taking chala from bread, Ra'av Shel Klaya Ba. Then a famine of complete destruction ensues. Yud Aleph. Dever ba la'olam. Pestilence comes into the world. Al mitot ha'amurot ba'Torah. For the death penalties that are described by the Torah. Shelo nimseru levetin. And not those that are delegated by the courts. Va'al perot shvi'it. And for improper use of the sabbatical year. Cherev ba'al la'olam. The sword of war comes into the world. Al inui hadin. For the delay of justice, va'al ivut hadin, and for the perversion of justice, va'al hamorim b'Torah shelo kahalacha, and for those who issue rulings of Torah that are not in accordance with halacha, chaya ra'a, wild beasts, ba'al olam, come into the world, al shvuat shav, for unnecessary oaths, va'al chilul Hashem, and for the desecration of God's name, galut ba'al olam, an exile comes into the world, al ovde avodah zarah, for idolatry, val gilui arayot, and for licentious behavior, val shvichut damim, and on the shedding of blood, val shmitat haaretz, and on not observing shmita in the land of Israel. So let's pause here and begin our discussion. So, Akiva, this idea of punishment, of consequence. Number one, are they the same thing, punishment and consequence? Number two, when I look at these, one of the things that are always in my mind when I have to consequence someone, whether it be one of my own children or whether it be a student, is does the consequence correlate with the activity that was done? So that hopefully the person understands why, right, the connection between the two. So do these strike you as correlating?
Well, I think the first question to answer is punishment and consequences, are they the same? And I think ideally they should be, right? For the reason that you just mentioned, if you're supposed to learn from what you did incorrectly, ideally, the punishment or consequence should make sense, right? And so let's talk about this first example. Not tithing. Some people go hungry is a punishment, and I assume those who tithe don't go hungry is the idea here, which in a way makes sense because the tithes go to the Kohanim, they go to the Levim, they go to, depending on which tithes, right, some of them also go to the poor. And so it makes sense, right? Because the tithes that are responsible for taking care of those who either don't own land or can't own land or don't have the ability to feed themselves, it makes sense that the punishment would be if others have to go hungry because you're not giving your necessary tithes, then the consequences is you go hungry. Makes sense. And so I think that way you learn from it. And obviously in the case of children, be they students, be they progeny, ideally we want them to learn on a smaller scale, right? So better you should learn in middle school that if you don't study on a regular basis, you won't do well, than learn that lesson in college when, by all rights, the classes should mean more and matter more to your eventual career outcomes. And so I think that we really, as adults who are trying to teach, really in whatever setting we are in to do that, be it through the parenting of children, be it through the education of children, and even as physicians, right? We always tell people things like, don't smoke. Why don't smoke? Because I'd rather have the conversation about not smoking when you're not smoking or when you just start or when you've done really minimal damage, as opposed to having a conversation following a heart attack or a stroke or some other kind of cardiovascular insult that comes from smoking tobacco, in this case. So, right, like these are all the ideas of providing education, teaching people about why to do things, why not to do things, and getting them to have really the, in the case of Pirkei Avot, in many ways, the right midot, which, Avi, I want to kind of go back and throw that part back to you. Is there, from the educational standpoint, a better way, in your opinion, to teach these midot than through punishment and consequences?
So I think that there has to be more than one way to teach midot for it to be effective, right? One of those ways does include reward and consequences, because if somebody is doing something wrong, or if they are pushing limits, which children tend to do because that is how they explore the world, then it's important to draw clear boundaries of when that is no longer okay, right? So, you know, giving them natural consequences of what happens when they cross a boundary or when they get close to a boundary is an important way of telling them that they have reached that, right? And sometimes we do that instinctively, right? So if somebody is walking, a toddler is wandering towards the street, we may yell to them, stop, 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 right? And it's in sort of an instinctive, right, and go and scoop them up. And in some cases, it may be a more thoughtful, well, if you're going to do that, then the consequence is you can, you know, if you're going to abuse your ability to use your phone or your electronic device, then the consequence is we're putting a timer on it so you can only use it X amount of time, or we're going to take it away for a period of time. And that can be a natural consequence that can help children learn their limits, and even adults learn their limits, because sometimes adults need that education as well. At the same time, I think that's not necessarily enough, especially today. I think the other two pieces that we really need to make sure exist, one is role models. And so it's important that we have role models of positive midot and what people should be doing. And while no one is perfect, I think it's fair to point to someone and say, look how well so-and-so does that midah, right? Because what you're doing is you're using that person as a positive role model for whatever midah you're trying to do, right? Look at Mrs. So-and-so. She is such a ba'alat chesed, right? She's always looking to help others out. She's always baking for people who are homebound or who have just had something happen in their family. And so, you know, you're trying to use that person as a positive role model, and hopefully you are also being a positive role model. Now, that does not mean that any of those people, including ourselves, are perfect, but rather that, on the other hand, we all probably do something rather well, right? We all have a positive midah, if not more than one. And so that can be a way to role model for our own children, and to point those out in others can also be a way to teach our children. And then the final way, and I think in some ways this is really the most important and something that people don't think about, but today I think is more important than ever, and that's teaching the midah directly, right? Really having a conversation about what it is, how it can be done, and why it's important for the individual and for society. So if you're talking about kavod, right, teaching your child what is kavod and how do we show kavod to other people, whether that means standing up when someone walks into the room, whether that means looking them in the eye when you're having a conversation with them, whether that's putting your hand out to shake their hand when you say good Shabbos, right? Those are actions and behaviors that you can teach your child in a positive way, right, what to do. Just like we have to teach table manners at a certain point so that our children learn them. They don't just pick them up by rote, right? And hopefully we do it in a positive way. Donnie, we eat our soup with a spoon. We don't pick the bowl up and drink it like a cat, right? Those.
When's the last time you saw a cat pick up the bowl?
You know, it's a very special cat. But at the end of the day, those kinds of opportunities to teach really make the lesson worthwhile, because when you do it in the moment, right, then we know that's the kind of learning that people are more likely to remember and be able to apply going forward.
So Avi, I just want to take that opportunity, by the way, to point out something that I think you accidentally did, but is actually, I think, has significant value, right? So in the statement of we eat with our soup with our spoon, we don't pick it up and drink it like a cat, because there's that component of silly questioning that comes in of how's a cat going to pick up the bowl and drink it, I think it adds an amount of levity in a corrective nature to make it memorable, but not necessarily painful in the corrective action. And I think that's really important when someone's trying to learn something, is that, yes, pain has certainly a valuable component in learning. That's why we have pain receptors. But at the same time, having the emotional construct to remember something in a positive way can also be significantly meaningful and valuable to learning a corrective action. That child theoretically would then remember to themselves kind of in a more of a jovial way, right? I have to eat with a spoon because I'm not a cat who can do magic.
The other thing, just to further that a little bit, Akiva, is one of the things I would guard against is using pain as a consequence. So, for instance, some of us are old enough to remember when children were given a patch on the tuchus or spanked as a consequence. And what we find, and you can speak to the research probably more than I can, is that all that teaches is that physical abuse is okay. It teaches them not to do that item again, but it also, there are equally effective ways and sometimes more effective ways to do that. So, for instance, if your child leaves out their Legos, having them walk across the Legos with bare feet might not be the best way to have them teach them to clean it up, even if that might mean that they might need another two or three reminders at later points to clean them up.
So Avi, I think part of the challenge that comes with physical discipline, also known as corporal punishment, is a lot of it depends on the context. So one of the things that they very much taught us, and granted this was, interestingly enough, a lesson that was taught by an older professor, was that one of the big differences between physical discipline and abuse, there are several. One of them is the fact of knowing why the punishment was given, right? So not dad came home from work angry, so therefore there was a physical punishment, and nobody knew why. Also that the punishment needs to, again, match what was done, and including an appropriate explanation of what was done. And the other thing about the fact of abuse by nature is socially hidden. And, right, so, you know, a lot of times as physicians, we're taught how to look for abuse. And people don't walk around with obvious signs of physical abuse often in areas that are obvious to everyone, right? So a teacher may notice that a child seems to be having some kind of discomfort from bruising, but oftentimes it's not on the areas that are exposed, it's on areas that are unexposed. And the juxtaposition that we were taught was the difference of, you know, back when it was much more common to use corporal punishment, physical discipline, adults would talk about it. Kids would talk about it. It was, oh, well, boy, I did this, and then this was what happened to me. And it was discussed, and it wasn't discussed in a way of anything that was in hidden terms. And I think that's a big part of what happens as well, because depending on the situation, there are reasons why, perhaps, logically having a discussion with the child may not work. Like, for example, talking to a six-month-old about why you can't stick things in the electrical socket may not be a fruitful conversation. And certainly we don't want them to learn from experience, even if now some of us as adults are still curious what happens if you stick a fork in the electrical socket. Some of us also know that we don't need to find out. But so that might be a situation of where one might say, well, you know, I slapped the hand. Again, not in a way to bruise and not in a way to overdo it, but I slapped the hand because I would much rather they feel the little zets of a slap on the hand than the shock of electricity going through a fork. So there are times, but again, it's also dependent on the situation. A 12-year-old doesn't necessarily need corporal punishment. A 12-year-old can have a rational conversation about why it's dangerous to do what they do. So I would put a couple of those different caveats, but that's not to say that it's necessarily, you know, go ahead and, you know, use that as your only mechanism for
discipline. I'm a bigger fan of take the fork away from the six-month-old.
But yes, one might also wonder why a six-month-old would have a metal fork.
Maybe. At the end of the day, so the idea of both corporal punishment, but also going back to something you spoke about earlier, the idea that the punishment needs to be appropriate not just for the action, but for the developmental stage that the child is in. And so, again, younger children, right, will need different kinds of consequences than older children. And perhaps the hardest challenge, and I speak about this from personal opinion, you're not quite at this stage yet, Akiva, is when your children go off to lead their own lives at a certain point and you have very little control over what they choose to do, and all you can do is sort of advise them / nag them. And hope that what you have done for the first X number of years has been successful enough. And if you're lucky, every once in a while they come back and they say things like, you know, Abba, every once in a while you know what you're talking about.
I will say that And I'm actually concerned maybe that, especially in our generation where there's a fear of letting your child fall, we're seeing more and more of what the risks are of not letting them leave the nest, because children who aren't allowed to make mistakes as children, and children who don't learn how to become resilient and handle life, don't learn how to handle life, and then, you know, they're 30-year-olds living in their parents' proverbial basement, which, and I'm not talking about, you know, kids who genuinely need more support, or kids who are in between something where they need a modicum of support. Again, I'm talking about people who don't know how to function in the world without a padding all around. And so I think it is very important to learn how to live and how to live in life. Again, following the rules of life, which, as much as parents, we want to say that there are lighter consequences and we don't want our children to struggle or fail or fall, we need to let that happen, because if not, then they don't develop the resilience of how to do it and how to avoid it on a larger scale.
And that sort of takes us to the other side of painful consequences, that sometimes life in and of itself just has painful consequences. You apply to get into college or for a program or something like that. For a job, and you don't get it. You don't get in. Or you express your love and devotion to someone, and after a short period of time, it becomes clear that it's not mutual, and so that relationship isn't successful, and that can also be painful. And I think it's important, and you can speak to this more, to acknowledge that pain and support your child through that pain, but not necessarily try to make it disappear, right? Allowing them to experience it while being empathetic is an important way to support them without trying to take it away and without trying to say it doesn't matter, because it does matter. And again, those are learning lessons, right? And hopefully they are things that the person can take in, eventually accept and grow from, and then incorporate that into who they are, right? When a relationship doesn't work out, it makes you sort of evaluate, well, what kind of person am I looking for? And that's an important question for people to ask themselves. If they did something silly and stubbed their toe, then it might ask them, might make them ask themselves, well, should I have some sort of slippers when I'm walking at night? So those kinds of pains are important to growing in life as well.
They are. And I think that, as you stated, it's very important. In fact, I was just having a conversation earlier about how some of the reasons why people do things like use substances and then end up struggling with substances, even if they are prescribed, even appropriately prescribed substances, what we're learning from our data, avoiding certain situations, avoiding emotions, rather than accepting that they exist and learning how to work with them or work through them, is incredibly important in life, to not avoid them, that is, to learn and develop that resilience, right? So, for example, we know that some of our best ways of handling anxiety are not to make the anxiety go away, per se, but to learn that the anxiety is yet another experience of a bully. And sometimes that bully is incredibly painful and incredibly tortuous. And this should not be construed as a suggestion of, you know, just suck it up and deal with it, because that's not what this is either. There's certainly different aspects to anxiety. And at the same time, a lot of what our treatment data suggests is that people who learn through different kinds of exposures how to see that despite the fact their anxiety feels like it will literally kill them, it won't. And once you experience that and you learn, yeah, this was terrible, and I got through it. And I've had people tell me all the time how amazed they are, and how, and you see just this light on the face. It's, you know, I have to say again, I've experienced as teaching as well, and so that opportunity when you see the child just get the light bulb switch, and then it goes on, and they're like, I got it. It's that same of watching that pride when they say, I got through it, and they see how much more power they have than they realized. And it can really be a very validating process. Pain in general, though, pain is supposed to exist. We are supposed to feel pain. If not, we wouldn't make it past 12 months or sooner. We are designed to have pain as both emotional and physical as ways to understand how to safely navigate this world and what we are not supposed to do, as well as what we must learn from.
So here's a question for around your Shabbos table. What is a painful experience that you had? Could be physical or could be emotional, that you're glad you had because it taught you an important lesson?